propagating in the reverse direction. So a leading signal does that. And the lagging signal in the forward direction to the director is. So that gives you enhance the Wagyu-like function that you're looking for. 95 feet of wavelength, 95 feet of separation. Because these are inverted V-like things, there's a little more to it than that. Is that at the part of the wire that's closest to the ground, the part of the wire that's, or whatever. We're worrying about where is the phase center element. And so you've got 95 feet of separation, but maybe the phase center is really separated by 130 feet, a half wave. So the exact length of cable that's going to give you the most directivity, hopefully, unless you're making a big variation to that one, Barry, but I can tell that if your two elements were, in my example, east-west of each other, and you want the one to the west to be the reflector and the one to the east to be the director, in my simplistic example, you want to aim a signal to the east. You're going to be firing the signal through a longer length of cable on the eastern antenna, and conversely, a shorter length of cable to the western antenna. That will cause your signal to fire to the east. Now, the exact length of cable difference that gives you the highest amount of gain, and that's a little more complicated. I can tell you which direction to go. I can't tell you exactly how far to go until I know the electronic phase antennas. That's a little bit more complicated than measuring the distance at the bottom or the distance in the middle that separates them. I wonder if that makes some sense, Barry. And two moon bounds.
Okay, yeah, okay. Well, you pretty much know how the thing is going to be laid out. You know there's two inverted Vs, the ends of which almost touch each other. In fact, they probably just about do touch each other. The feed point, of course, is going to be the center of these things, and that's going to be 95 feet apart. I would assume, just taking a guess at this, that because the antennas are coming towards each other, that phase point that we're looking for to be somewhere between, in other words, halfway down each antenna, approximately halfway in. I think that's a good approximation of the spot that we're looking for, if you follow what I'm saying. So that would, I've got my calculator here, but that would be half of 40 bar over.
Yeah, where they're almost touching at the bottom and 95 feet apart, I'm going to make a very rough guess that your electronic phase centers of each antenna are around 63 feet apart, very close to the quarter wave at 75 meters. If so, you're going to get the maximum signal in the direction of the desired if you feed the two electronically 62 feet difference. If you're using ordinary 50-ohm coax cable that has a velocity factor of 66%, I got to make sure, 66% velocity factor, that means 41 feet of cable difference. Because if it's 66% velocity factor, if it's polyethylene cable, will act like 63 feet electronically. So 41 feet of extra cable, rough approximation, 41 feet of extra cable to the antenna in the direction you want to fire. So if your antenna is going to have 41 feet more cable, and I think that's a good beginning position if that kind of data is not already in the original article. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, well, I have no article. I'm really doing this on the fly, so. I just missed one piece. You said 41 feet of cable. What kind of cable? Because there's a velocity factor to worry about here. So, what is the actual degrees that you're trying to move this? And
If I was using RG8 cable, polyethylene type RG8, RG214, RG213, it has a velocity factor of 66%. 41 feet of that cable will give you the same delay as 63 feet. I'm assuming that the electronic phase centers of your two antennas are in the vicinity of 63 feet apart. It's not as far apart as the apexes, and it's nowhere near as narrow to being close to each other as the tips. The tips are almost touching each other, as you said. So you know the electronic separation between those antennas is a hell of a lot more than 0 feet, and nowhere near as much as 95 feet. And I made a guess that it's around 63. It is an eighth wave. 90 degrees electronic of RG8 or RG214 coax cable, if it has a velocity factor of 60, how did I calculate that? I assume that I'm looking for 63 feet of electronic delay in the cable, 90 degrees at 75 meters. 63 feet of delay multiplied by 0.66, the velocity factor, if that's the cable you're using, comes out approximately 41 feet.
Yeah, it does. It certainly does. A regular dipole is about 50 ohms at the feed point. An inverted V, where these things are bent back like that, I think the impedance gets lower. So I wouldn't want to use 75 or 72 ohm coax. It makes sense to use 50 ohm coax for this, huh?
Okay. A full half-wave dipole in free space is 72 ohms, 36 ohms on each plane, which is the symmetric equivalent of a dipole. So, dipole is 72 ohms, but because you've got it vertically polarized, because you've got it bent in this way, because you've got a lot of other hardware around it, earth on the bottom end and tower in the middle and so on, I'm making a rough guess that your resistive impedance might be in the vicinity of 50 ohms, in which case 50 ohm cable is a good cable to use. However, even if we miss on the impedances, you've got an antenna tuner, and even if the standing wave is intolerable to the average amateur, and to a solid-state transmitter, of course that would be a sugar, as they say, really crazy. But because a 6-to-1 standing wave ratio with a perfect 50-ohm transmitter would only lose half your power, you'd be 3 dB down, you're on the air, not to worry. So exact impedance matching, don't allow yourself to lose a lot of sleep over that one, Barry. One step at a time. Make a leap of faith, assume it's a 50-ohm antenna, put it together with these lengths of cable that can be switched when you want arrangement, and then you'll get a chance to measure the impedance. You may find out the whole antenna is tuned to 3800 when you want it to be tuned to 3600, and things like that are very easily worked out later on by adding and subtracting lengths to the dipoles and so on to get rid of a reactive component. So I think you're a lot better off than you think you are. I think it's going to be a real fun antenna. Back to you for any further questions. KQI, you'll be in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah. Well, you might see where I'm leading with this. I don't plan on putting everything out at the tower. I want to bring the two coax cables from the antennas all the way into the room, into the shack, so that I will have a waterproof place to put my my stub, which is going to move this thing ahead 90 degrees or whatever we decided. So I think it probably doesn't. In this case, so it makes sense, I guess, what I want to do is to bring the coax all the way into the shack. They're going to take this 63-foot piece of 50-ohm coax, in this case, and put it in either one leg or the other, and see what happens. So, are you comfortable with all of that? Because that's my immediate plan.
To be double-darn sure, the two pieces of cable you bring into the shack, which are going to be quite a number of wavelengths long, there's a couple of ways you can do a simple electronic measurement to make sure that both cables are electronically the same length. I mean, even though both of them may be a beautiful, brand-new, spanking piece of RG214 cable, they can have a slightly different velocity factor, and after 100 feet of cable, you can build up some phase shift. So, once you lay out your two pieces of cable, there's some very simple testing I can give you on a future TechNet, in which we can measure the fact that both of your cables are electronically the same length. And therefore, bringing them in the shack is a beautiful way to go, and therefore you're going to be weather-protecting all of your switching hardware. You'll have the ability to plug in longer and shorter pieces of cable to see if you get more gain in that direction and so on, and run a whole lot of fun experiments from the shack. And electronically separated by 63 feet, and you're going to put a phasing length of cable in there that is electronically 63 feet long, but because of the 66% velocity factor, physically that cable is going to be around 41 feet long, from my rough guess. So when you said you're adding 63 feet of cable, I wouldn't, in order to get 63 feet of electronic difference. I think you see that one, Barry. N2MB, K2LIW.
Yes, I do. I was figuring 41 feet. And the beauty of being able to bring this into the shack is I could take my little fittings and add 10 more feet or something like that and really have fun with it. Exactly. And it wouldn't affect the switching, you know, just put 10 more feet in my little phasing line and see what happens, you know. It's a shame this isn't on 400 megs or something where I could just have a little sliding thing there, you know. Then again, a 2LMZ on 400 megs is kind of stupid anyway. So it's going to work. And even if the phase is a little different in the coax, considering it's such a low frequency, you really got to add several feet of coax before you see a difference. Now, you and I kind of think microwave where, you know, a foot of coax would be devastating. But in this case, I don't think it's going to be too critical. I think we beat this one to death, and I think I know where I'm going with it. On Richie's amplifier, I just had a couple of thoughts. We never determined how he's connecting to that coil. That might account for the coil getting hot. I don't think it had any effect on the sparking and arcing. I thought that the two tubes were not exactly driven the same. He said they weren't acting like they were exactly in parallel. And also, I believe he's testing this thing with the case open, and he mentioned to me that there's RF all over the shack when he's doing this. It's actually shutting down. So, what are the possibilities of him having feedback here, K2RW and 2MB?
Yeah, I've operated a number of transmitters with the case open. I can't do it on a parallel kilowatt amplifier, of course, because that's a key part of the resonator. In the case of my 6-meter transmitter, which was made with years with the cage off, until I finally went and built a cage for it, I had to make sure that nobody walked into the shack and reached over and touched anything during the time it was operating, because 2,000 volts were on there. And I eventually put a cage over it, and no real change in performance per se. When you study normal layouts of pi tank circuits, you'll find out that 98% of the energy is contained in the tank. And yes, a receiver in the room is going to be seeing a signal that's a zillion dB above sensitivities, and you're giving it millivolts and volts of signal. But human-wise, I think you're worried about biohazard. I don't think you have to. Also, if it's the wiring and the taps that go to the coil that's creating the heating, he would see melting solder on those components as opposed to on the coil itself. Flowing in between the coil and those two capacitors, that's where the majority of the current is flowing. What's really going on is that if the tank circuit is properly designed, it's running with a loaded Q of approximately 10. And Q has four definitions. The definition we care about most here is voltage rise at resonance or current rise at resonance. Well, whatever current his tube is turning out, you could say the resonance effect of the pi network is multiplying and so the current flowing through that coil and everything in between it and its capacitors is where the real high current heating characteristic is located. And so there seems to be ample history of this kind of a circuit that says that you really got to have quarter inch diameter copper tubing, and something that's much smaller in diameter is not going to. And I think when you do a thorough study of silver-plated copper versus copper, you're going to find very little difference for overall performance, because unless the silver plating is done with extreme care, with a silver plating house that really knows how to silver plate microwave circuits, unless that's done, most techniques for putting on silver may give you physical protection, may give you beauty, but I'm not going to give you RF improvement. A lot of people will buy this paste that you can buy that you rub onto the copper, and yes, you can say to yourself, now it's silver plated, and I'm going to have a lot less loss. Well, if you believe that, you're a little bit naive. The process by which you electroplate silver onto copper is a deep art form. It is a thing you would believe. The houses that do it correctly go through ridiculous thorough procedures for making the surfaces smooth, decleaning solutions. The silver plating process is done with fancy circuitry to make sure that the current flow to each and individual surface, even the ones around the corner, on the inside of the coil, the outside of the coil, to make the current flow that's doing the electroplating be even, that's very difficult. The electroplated silver tends to Gumm. You have to do some kind of a burnishing operation multiple times in between multiple steps of electroplating. And there's also a technique by which they put a partially DC compensated AC signal on there to do the electroplating so that they're putting on a little bit more copper than they're taking off on each half cycle of the 60 cycles. So there's an odd form of doing that for the right periods of time in between the burnishing and so on. You got to do all of this if you really want clean, low resistivity silver on top of that copper, until it's directly on top of copper. You do that and the silver, correction, let me back off on that one. That's gold. Gold will migrate through the copper. You cannot put gold directly on copper. There's got to be an intermediate slashing of another material. Otherwise, the gold will slowly migrate through the copper and disappear on you. Silver, I think, doesn't do that. There may be a substance that has to be put in between, but total procedures required for really making low resistivity silver on top of copper. It is so complicated, so rare. I mean, I was working with a vendor 7 years ago, that was running into this problem headlong, and every time these silver-plated circuits that were being done by a guy that the utensils that people use for eating, and we thought that we went to that house and he would do a good enough job for us, we always ended up with higher resistivity with the silver than without. So don't go there unless you really assure you that the exact right vendor or somebody has already produced silver-plated copper material for you by a house that knows how to do it. So even if you get the silver on there perfectly, it has only a few percent better conductivity than the copper. And on top of that, people worry themselves sick because the copper develops copper oxide on the surface and it looks very homely. And you think that you're going to get a tremendous amount of loss because you've got copper oxide. Well, it's very similar to the guy that makes himself an 80-meter dipole out of 8-gauge household wire, out of 14-gauge household wire, and he asks you the question, should I leave the rubber insulation on or not? And you and I know, Barry, having done it, it makes it a little bit heavier, gives a little bit higher wind resistance. Maybe if the rubber is the right kind of material, the ice will flake off a little bit more easily, but the RF energy doesn't see the rubber. It goes down through the insulator until it finds the copper and it does its thing. Well, the same thing with the copper oxide on top, which is the insulator. The RF will go through that until it finds the real meat of the copper, where it will do its conduction. So the ugliest looking surface at anything except very high microwave frequencies doesn't matter. Okay, maybe some of those comments will help. Maybe somebody's got some further comments on this. Is that
KEY to MLB.
Okay, KEY and MLB in that order. And Barry too. Mel, go ahead first.
Hey, the Q of the tank circuit is 12, and Dickie put two vacuum variables into the rig. Finally, he said, that one said he bought two vacuum variables. C1, 375 PF, 10 KV, and C2, 1,000 PF, wound up costing a humongous amount of money. But he said this is what he just went step by step and wouldn't give up on it. Just kept pouring the money in, and that was the final solution on it, was put in two vacuum variables over.
Yeah, that's what I was afraid of. The vacuum variables can cost you, could be mechanically very difficult, and he's not going to get that much more performance. I guarantee if he properly cleans the C1 capacitor he's got now, 4.5 kilovolts at 190 picofarad, that could be a beautiful capacitor. If he makes sure it's nice and clean, and in worst case, he puts sheets of Teflon in there, guarantee he can double the voltage rating of that capacitor. It'll never arc over again. I've done that, and so with a little bit of care, I'm sure he can do that. Let's see what Frank's got to ask to end all this. K2MLB, go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, a good evening. Comment or his situation. This is not directly related, but in terms of his suggestion of bringing the feed lines in the shack, many years ago I had 211 element Telrex antennas. They were 36 feet long on a tower. One was 36 feet high, the other 72, and we were wondering about the gain of stacking, and ran separate feed lines matched into the shack from each antenna, and then I had a double pole, two-section coax switch right in the shack switch, and was able to select upper beam, lower beam, or both in phase. So, I mean, it was using the two lines the way you suggest for him and doing it inside.
Yeah, I kind of feel that's going to work like a charm. Barry, you got it.
Okay, yeah, one thing, I may have given Richie a problem because he had called me earlier in the day.
Had
a very hard time taking the taps off of the coil. Couldn't heat it up with a soldering iron. I don't know exactly how he got it off, but it came to my attention that they obviously didn't use regular solder to attach this. They must have, what I thought they used was silver-bearing solder. It tends to work a little better, and it heats up at a higher heat level to melt it. So I suggested that to him. I don't know whether he did it or not. I'm thinking that he needed a little torch or something to heat up that silver-bearing solder. I don't think he had it. And I don't know if his regular soldering iron could have melted it. So that's why it keeps troubling me about that connection. Over.
Yeah, many companies will use silver-bearing solder for two reasons. And temperature-wise, it'll tolerate a much higher temperature before it melts. So for at least two reasons, they may have used a higher temperature solder. Even if they didn't, you take a 250-watt soldering gun, and you try to unsolder a great big chunk of copper, it can be very difficult. When it comes to unsoldering a large, massive structure, my favorite way of doing it is to use the soldering iron tip of a Bernzomatic torch. You don't want to use an open flame torch directly on the going to be making copper oxide like no tomorrow, and future soldering and beauty of the circuit and melting down everything else nearby is some of the hazards you got to worry about. So the soldering iron tip that goes onto a Bernzomatic torch is equivalent to about 1,000-watt iron when you turn it up to full blast as a catch. Look out that they happen to be aimed towards something that can melt, that can give you a lot of trouble. So you got to be very careful. You may have to build yourself some metal shields to deflect the flame away from some of the delicate portion of the circuit. And so to unsolder it in order to change to a larger diameter copper tubing is a good way to go. Right away, is it silver-bearing solder or ordinary solder, would be to take a small rat-tail file to it. Ordinary solder is very soft and will clog up your pores of a rat-tail file real fast. Silver-bearing solder tends to chip away as if you're using the file on a piece of brass, so to speak. That gives you a little bit of a clue. Physical appearance also gives you another clue, and melting temperature. When you do with the iron, bring the ordinary piece of solder and touch to it, and depending on where the ordinary piece of solder behaves, particularly before the silver-bearing solder melts. In other words, you could be bringing it up in temperature, the solder that's there doesn't quite melt yet, and you touch it with your ordinary solder, and if the ordinary solder melts right away, that's a very strong clue that what was there was silver-bearing solder. So, and when he does reconstruct the coil out of a larger diameter, it would be nice that he did it with silver-bearing solder. I don't think he has to. If he's got a big enough chunk of copper, then ordinary solder, I think, will do it. And if at worst the ordinary solder does drip away, it's not a disaster. It's a fixable situation. You may have some comments on that, Barry. M2MB, K2LIW, in the TechNet.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I was just a little troubled with the actual physical connection between the jumper and the tap on that coil. I'm wondering how he's doing it, and, you know, I'm thinking that might be where the heat's coming from, not the coil. It may be heating up the coil, but it may not be the coil that's getting hot, you know, in the burning things. That's what's bothering me, but, you know, I could be wrong. I could be completely wrong about it. Now, that's why I suggested he use silver-bearing solder, because, as they say, it could take more heat to that connection, and, I think they did, because he was telling me he was having fits getting this off of there, and that, you know, kind of adds up.
Okay. The elegant approach would be to go out and buy these TEMPLAC-type temperature-sensing paints and paint various portions of the circuit and find out who gets hot first. But to try to find TEMPLAC material at the right temperature characteristics today without a great big order and weight and buy a zillion pounds of it for the minimum order. Without going through all of that, a poor man's equivalent would be to put little dabs of wax, candle wax, on various portions of the circuit. Run the circuit for 10 seconds. That'll very rapidly let you know who's getting hot first. What do you think of that, Barry?
I have an infrared camera, which might be real easy to do. They're small. I use them a lot now for business, you know, for alarm systems, and Maybe we could just do that, look at it with an infrared camera.
Another beautiful approach, but there's one catch, emissivity. I could have two metals side by side, both at the identical temperature. If one has higher infrared emissivity, your infrared camera will think one is much hotter than the other. Now, as long as he's got copper, copper, and copper, both the coil and the tap and the contact over to the rotary switch and whatever, no problem. But if there's differences in materials there, you got to worry a little bit about that. With the combination of the candle wax or any other kind of meltable wax or plastic that you can put on various portions of the circuit, run the circuit briefly, you'll rapidly find out who's getting hottest to fastest. Back to you, Barry. By the way, that infrared camera you got, is that a CCD type? What brand name? Roughly how expensive? How do I get my hand to you, Barry?
Okay. Well, they're getting cheaper every day. Most of them now are infrared, but I think 3/4 of the cameras coming out now are both infrared and regular. When the light in the room gets low, they see very well in dark rooms. I was doing it, and I compared it, and we did not have the infrared. It was absolutely incredible. I can do it right now. Just I go on the internet and look at some of my clients and look at their cameras. I have one that has four cameras in a single room. The three infrareds, it looks like somebody left the lights on. When the other camera is pitch black, you can't see a thing when you switch to it. That's pretty amazing. And they are cheap. They're about $140. They are color cameras, but of course, when the light gets low, you're not using that. You're using the infrared part of it.
So you get a monochrome picture. Wow. I got to make believe there's $150 sitting in your pocket, and I want one of those, Barry. Get me one of those. You've got $150 of my money sitting in your pocket right now. Make believe. Okay? I'll pay you well. Back to you, Barry.
Okay. Is it indoors or outdoors?
Indoors is more than good enough. I am fussy.
Good. I'll have one pretty soon.
Fantastic. Okay. Alrighty. Before we go over to Paul, WS2N, who has a comment he wants to make, and is also going to give us some, who signed in earlier, please give me a call with us right now.
W2PNJ, I'm a late come, I just have a comment.
No rush. K2MLB.
Okay, MLB and PNJ. PNJ, please, go right ahead.
Okay, just hearing the comment about infrared camera, how about one of those Greenlee, $90 to $100, direct reading temperature. It's got a small eighth of an inch diameter infrared, you know, a laser beam that goes on the item you want to measure the temperature.
That's one approach, but I really want a recognizable photograph of the object in question. So, and I don't want to know the exact temperature, but I want to be able to see things that are hot. And so, what Barry's got sounds like it's the right thing, but now let's see now. Who was the other person who wanted to make a comment? I wasn't smart enough to write down the call letters.
Well, I can wait until after Paul said it's just K2MLB.
Very fine, Frank. We'll get back to you. Paul, for the S2N, you have the floor, sir.
Okay, Dick. Good evening. I just want to make one comment, not related to the space program. This has to do with a TV show that will be on this Wednesday. I don't know if you've ever seen the show The Mythbusters, Dick, but it's a pretty good show. It's they do a lot of testing of different things, flaws or whatnot, or if it's possible to do. These two guys they've been at it for a couple of years now, a little quirky, but a lot of times they have game-related items, if you want to call it that, you know, make antennas, see if cell phones interfere with planes, that type of thing. But this week, they have admitted, as I saw advertised, and you asked a question about years ago, it was a riddle. And I believe it was on the Lockfield net when they had the CACnet over there. And they had the, I think, Roy WB2ZIT, he was involved back then. And the question had to do with birds. When they fly, take off, does it change the weight of this truck? And it turned out to be a big riddle and went on for a week or two, I guess. I don't know. I remember that particular thing. And now on this show, the way they advertise it, one of the things on Wednesday that they're going to try, to, they probably usually do three or four, five different things, is this theory about birds flying in a truck. So I thought I'd bring that up. Dick, I don't know if you've ever seen that on the Discovery Channel out here on Concord. What's up, Dick?
Absolutely. Discovery Channel, one of my favorites, and the Mythbusters, one of my favorite set of people. Only once in a blue moon do they do things a little bit less technically accurate than I would do it, it says here. But for the most part, I think those guys are right on target. And this whole idea of the fool, mankind's going to argue about for a few more generations. How does an aircraft wing develop lift? How does a helicopter fly? How does a bird fly? And I thought at one time I was the inventor of this puzzle about the birds in the truck. And does the truck sense the weight of the birds when the birds are in flight inside of the fully enclosed trailer of a tractor-trailer truck? Well, supposedly, the story goes that when Lucky Lindy, or Lindbergh, was flying across the Atlantic Ocean, there supposedly was a periodically would land on the steering wheel, the yoke, or periodically would fly around in the cabin. And one of the methods he, in the story, used for staying awake is he would try to calculate, is he burning more fuel when the housefly is in flight versus when the housefly has landed on some particular part of the cockpit? That's the second of all, you and I know that the difference is equivalent to spitting in the ocean, and you're going to measure the change in altitude of the ocean, change in depth of the ocean. Much too small a phenomenon. Second of all, I have personally sat in the cockpit of the Spirit of St. Louis, the full mock-up model that is now sitting at the Cradle of Aviation Museum on Long Island. I have sat in that cockpit, looked out that window, and realized that in the environment he was in, the wind that was whistling through that cockpit would be so darn significant, you could not keep a housefly in that cockpit. So I don't believe the story. But still, there's a beautiful website I can indicate to you, which is indicating an experiment that was done by the Langley Research Center, in which they put a full-size Piper Cub wing in a wind tunnel and measured what was going on. And yes, without Adam in the wing. But the real question, if you're a good scientist, is that a cause or is that an effect? And as they conducted that experiment of generating lift, not the cause of the lift. And once you start going down that road and you start questioning yourself, you start asking a question like, when a person is water skiing, what's keeping the skis on the top of the water? Is there a lower pressure on top of the ski versus the bottom of the ski? Why don't you put some weight on your waist so that you would sink in the pool? And now you use your flippers, you flip your feet, and you keep your head above water. Are you using Bernoulli's principle to do that? Are you really creating a difference in the water pressure on one side of the flipper versus the other? Well, once you read the proper article, and if you want, I can well-written articles on this, which talk about the Coander effect and a number of other things, and say the Bernoulli principle is much too simplistic to explain flight in open air requirement like a wing. I'll admit that the Bernoulli principle works beautifully in a closed structure like a carburetor, but in an open structure like a wing in open air, I think another 98% is the so-called wedge effect, action and reaction of deflecting a mass of fluid. The average person, you ask them, what is the mass of a cubic meter of air? All of the engineers I ask that question to, if they don't have an aerodynamic background, will say approximately a gram to a milligram is the weight of a cubic meter of air. The answer is 2.7 pounds, more than a kilogram. Air is a massive substance. You know that from sticking your hand out the window of a car grand. A guy named Timothy McVeigh crushed a building in Oklahoma City using nothing but a shockwave and air. None of that bomb struck the building. Just a shockwave and air did. And that shockwave and air went down the alley. He was a couple of blocks away, and it plastered him up against the building. And he said, what the blank was that? He didn't even understand what he was dealing with, if you know what I mean. So air and flight and the theory of flight, it's really something else. So if these guys, do they say in the advertisement, Paul, how they enter the truck? Maybe they're going to put insects in a structure, in some kind of a closed structure, and carefully measure when the insects are sitting on the bottom of the structure versus flying in the middle of it, measure the difference in weight with a well-balanced scale. And by the way, before I pass it back to you, when I was saying this on the other TechNet that was 147.21, I remember a number of people getting quite angry at me because of the announcements I made as to how a wing develops lift. And thank goodness, again, on it wasn't Discovery Channel, it was on PBS television, Public Broadcasting System. Newton's Apple was the name of the program, and they flew a radio-controlled model helicopter above a round dining room table with the cable being sitting on a scale. And they measured the apparent weight of the table with the helicopter sitting on the table was the same. The air being deflected downward by the rotary blades of the helicopter, the radio control model helicopter, was making the table think that the full weight of the helicopter was on the table, even though they were separated by about a foot and a half. If people hadn't seen that Newton's Apple program at the time that I made my pronouncements, people were getting angry enough that I was afraid they were going to come over and cut off my coax cable, if you know what I mean. Back to you, Paul. How do you think they're going to prove it? WS2N, K2RW on the TechNet.
Yeah, I like your scenario. The truck was going over a bridge, and the bridge could exactly hold a certain kind of tonnage. And, you know, if the guy hit the truck with a stick or something, and the birds took off, you know, would he make it across the bridge? You had a great scenario there, Dick. Well, it's the brick. I mean, this goes by, I think, 3 seconds thick with the coming attraction. I just saw, I guess it was yesterday or the day before, this 3 second shot. Sure enough, these birds are flying in a truck, and here's this guy with a stick. So I'm assuming they've got the birds in the truck, so they've got a guy in it. They've got a guy in the truck with a stick. I don't know, Dick. Well, see, like I said, this is really grounded. It just looked to me like this is what they're going to be doing on that show on Wednesday. So I got to make sure to record it and just to rewind it, you know, check on me. Sometimes they'll say something real quick and things like that, and you rewind it, you double check on it. But I think they're going to use real birds and. I don't know. As far as the planes flying, I always think it's kind of like the turbine, you know. Everybody thinks when the turbine is spinning, generating the power, the powerhouse, the steam is going through, the steam is hit blade turn. Well, it's not. It's the steam, after it hits the blade, the steam leaves. It's, every action has an equal or opposite reaction. It's the steam leaving the blade, which is making that blade be forced in a certain direction. I think this is the whole true for airplanes, too. When the molecules of the plane, once they've touched the wing of the plane, and now they've left the plane, I think that's where you add to it.
Yeah, how the blades of a multi-bladed turbine, whether it be a turbojet engine or a steam turbine used for generating power, what's really going on there is part of the same phenomenon. The theory of flight has been for going on 100 years. Like every other problem in physics, if you think it's simple, you don't understand the problem. Mother Nature didn't design this universe to be simple for mankind to understand. You could say she or whatever intelligence designed it in such a way that we're going to be busy studying. I worked with some very intelligent people in the Air Force in my former occupation. I remember running into a man with a doctorate in the subject who was working at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base doing basic research. And I asked him, hey, John, how does a wing develop lift? He said, funny you should ask. There's at least two theories of operation. The Bernoulli's principle is one. The wedge effect, action and reaction, Newton's third law is the other. And each time in history, one theory field of work you're involved in at the time. Bruce and 2LIV and I were going up to a flea market in Rochester, New York, a few years ago, and we stopped off at Elmira, the sailplane capital of the United States. And They've got a beautiful museum there of all the past sailplanes and real sailplanes will field, giving instructors and the students. And the instructor seemed to have a little bit of a free time where he was sitting off to one side with his arm against the fence. I walked over and told him of my theory of flight and told him about the experiment that was done by the Langley Research Center, one of the best aeronautical research centers we've got in the United States, a division of NASA. And I told him about the website that indicates what the experiment did and what it indicated. And he got extremely angry at me for poisoning the minds of his students that were within earshot. He ordered me off the field, told me never to come back. And I started thinking about that. If what I said, which is a quasi-logical sounding theory, happened to be dead wrong, and the person knew that, he would simply say, I strongly disagree with you. You can hold that objection. Told me that I had stepped on some kind of a very sacred cow. I had hit some kind of a sore spot in his education. He had walled this whole area off in his mind as to what's going on. He decided he's only going to preach the normal theory of flight. He wants no other theory to be present within earshot on his field when he's doing instructing of his students. I could have asked him, what about that plane that's in front of you that's towing up these sailplanes? Could it fly inwards, upside down? Where's the Bernoulli's principle in that case? Without a doubt, the airplane flies less efficiently upside down, but it flies upside down. There's a zillion questions you can ask about this one. There's a lot more going on, as you can tell. I think you... So that sounds like a darn good thing to listen to. This coming Wednesday, MythBusters on the Discovery Channel is going to be giving us a little bit more of experimental evidence of what is the theory of flight. How does an airplane wing really work? How does a helicopter really work? And by the way, the misinformation along these lines, in my opinion, is lethal. I can give you the 87 that crashed on Far Rockaway. I can give you examples of the Alaskan Airlines flight that crashed in the Atlantic Ocean in front of Los Angeles Airport. In each of these cases, because the pilot involved did not have proper understanding of where lift is coming from, because he was taught theory of flight by way of the Bernoulli principle, therefore that misinformation caused him to do an action as a pilot that caused lots of people to die. Both of those accidents, and a lot more of them just like it, were thoroughly avoidable if the pilot had the right information of how the wing is developing lift. Aircraft to fail would not have occurred. The person would not have done that action if he really understood how flight is taking place. Paul, on a more pleasant note, tell us what's going on in space. If you have a tiny bit more power, it would help. There's a little bit of scratchiness on your signal because at the repeater site tonight with all dissipation static, and so there's a little bit of cracklies on your signal. But it still sounds pretty good, and if you're already at full power, stay right there and tell us what's going on in space. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, up the high power, how's this?
Sounds better. I hope your transmitter can take it, and hope you don't create any TBI in the home QTH.
Nah, the only reason I went back down to 10 is because one of the computers in the room packed up a little bit. So I moved the antenna a little bit, maybe that'll help get rid of that problem with that computer. It's going to go up, but boy, I mean, that storm really knocked the heck out of it. All the hailstones that hit the external tank, I think it's been under repair for a long time now. It was supposed to go up in April, and then now it looks like June. There is talk of sending a shuttle up to rescue the Hubble Space Telescope. And now, by pushing this down range, you've got a problem. You've got five missions that were supposed to go off this year. You're not going to get that. So sooner or later, you deem the show garbage after 2010, so I'm a little worried about that. But they're going to finish rebuilding the tank, and although they did have another tank delivered, they were thinking about using that one. The wife I heard as a couple of days ago that they are going to reuse the damaged tank. The repairs that have been done on it have come along quite a bit. as well as some of the repairs to the tail hits on the side of it. That's been fixed for quite a while, but they're finishing up on the tank. So that should be good. The International Space Station, they've got another paying tourist up there, $25 million. He's one of these billionaires. Oh, I forgot his name. He's the guy that when you get onto a computer, you get on with PayPal. He's that guy. He's enthusiast, but he's one of the the fifth one. They had Dennis Tito a while back. He was the first one, and Mark Shuttleworth from South Africa, another computer guy. Tito was some kind of a big investor, and they've had two others since. One woman. That was the last one, and this is the thing now. $20 million to go to the International Space Station for half a dozen days or whatever it is, and then he'll be coming back with the astronaut and cosmonaut that have been up there, and he'll be returning. Sunita Williams, she'll be staying on board. She's been up there for months on end. She'll be up there for a couple more months, I guess. That's a say on that. Not much more going on. All the unmanned missions are either on their way or still operating on Mars. And different missions are going well. I haven't heard anything good, bad, or ugly dealing with the robotic missions. You know, there's one on the way to an asteroid years out. You've got the New Horizons going to Pluto. So, all of these missions are doing well. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N.
Please find Bill. Bill. And that's amazing. $25 million for 6 days. But I guess if you're a very rich person in general and have nothing better to do with your money, that could be certainly a once-in-a-lifetime type experience. And everything I hear tells me that the views you get from space looking down at the Earth from 135, 145 nautical miles, seeing the true thick blackness of space, colors of the Earth, and zipping over all of those land masses is really something else. What troubles me is that trained astronauts, one half of them, astronauts and cosmonauts, one half of them when they get into space, spend the first 20... Clear and simple, space sickness. Your vestibular system, I think it's called, in other words, your automatic balancing system in the body. Time in your life, you have more than a couple of seconds of sustained weightlessness. And so those senses get very confused. Taking Dramamine doesn't completely eliminate the problem. There are astronauts who, on the first two space flights, didn't get space sick, and on the third one, they do. And so one of the real causative agents, I'm not completely clear. So picture a person who spends a whole lot of money going into space is going to be there for a couple of things, the first day and a half, sicker than he's ever been in his life. I guess it would still be worth it. There's quite a bit of risk involved. And so getting back to your other subject, that is the hail damage that occurred to the external tank and to the shuttle itself. It looks like that's going to be causing delay in scheduling, which of course is putting the repair, the timely repair of the Hubble Space Telescope in a little more risk, and that's a bit unfortunate. With hindsight, I wish they had some kind of space shuttle, the space shuttle when it's sitting on the pad, just in case a hailstorm is coming along to protect it from a thing like that. But in the whole history of the space program, the hail hitting in Florida is a, I guess, a once-in-a-lifetime experience type thing. So maybe you don't spend $1 zillion building a shield for just that event. Hindsight again. Let's see what's the latest in Manhattan Beach. I'm sure you've gotten some one or two emails this week, Mel. Quite possibly they're on subjects that you and I should be discussing. And so bring us up to date, sir. The co-operator of the TechNet. We keep coming up with new titles. You have to come up with the real title you want, Bell. K2KEY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Hey, we'll take a vote on it. All right, very good, Dick. This is K2KEY. Yeah, I've been answering the emails, and I think I've tried to, you know, shun everybody out there. I may be a day or two late. I'm not trying to shun anybody that I could possibly help, it's just that I'm thrilled. One of the emails that I've gotten, in fact, I've gotten several on this subject, Dick, it seems to be confusion about DBs. The last one was from a young fella, says, I hear you guys say DBI, DBD, DBM. He says, what are you talking about? Well, weeks ago, we just got into it briefly about the Serato booster angle. So I gave him just the background and where he could go, actually, and read up on it. Now, all right, we'll let that go. But I thought we would do just a little bit of insight into DB, how it's derived and all, because it seems like the articles that they print on DBs, the more they read or the more they see of them, they said they're too complicated. They need some of my simple math to understand it. They said it gave them a lot of insight into things like rectangular and polar, how to go over one to the other, vectors, and some other my other old-time math. Think of me, that old-time math thing. So I thought maybe if we have the time, we could discuss DBs, a little explanation and some examples, and give a couple of actual applications. So what do you think, over?
I like it. Beautiful subject. I'm going to give you two paragraphs on the subject, and I'm going to ask you to add to it. Decibel. And wireless engineers, probably a few others, but at least those two fields use decibels essentially every single day of their life. The basic term bell, B-E-L-L, is a factor that was given honor Alexander Graham Bell, the supposed inventor of the telephone. I say supposed because there are other people claiming to be co-inventors near the same time, both in the United States and in other countries. But we'll assume that Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone. And the telephone is a primarily acoustic instrument throughout most of its 100-and-some-odd-year history. And if you study the human hearing system, you'll realize that it has a huge dynamic range. The strongest possible signal that your hearing can tolerate, that screeching sound you hear in a subway, or that roar you hear from a jet engine if you're very close to it, the strongest sound that you can, for brief exposures of that sound, versus the weakest sound you can listen to, a whisper from a pretty girl, 20 feet away, the ratio between those two is something in the vicinity of 140 decibels. That means if you put one with 14 zeros after it, that's the ratio of the weakest amount of sound power your hearing can interpret versus the strongest amount of sound power that your hearing can tolerate without damage. Such huge numbers, if you express them directly in watts or milliwatts, would be very difficult. Micro, nano, pico, femto watts on the weak side, and you'd be dealing with kilo, mega, gigawatts on the strong side. Huge numbers of difference. What Alexander Graham Bell and other people with their research on human hearing discovered is that the human hearing system, bell is a ratio of 10 to 1 in power. Well, sometimes you don't want 10 to 1 in power, you want 1/10 of that. The word deci means 1/10, just like the word centi means 1/100, and milli means 1/1000th. You know, there's something called gram, and 1/1000th of a gram is called a milligram. Again, if you start off with a gram and you want a centigram. If you want 1/10 of a gram, you could talk about a decigram. So deci means 1/10, and bell means this logarithmic phenomena. So The human hearing system responds logarithmically. The bell is too big a number. They decided to make a basic unit, one-tenth that big, decibel, logarithmic, but they're always a ratio. That's a hard thing to believe. When I talk about a milliwatt or a watt, I'm talking about a specific amount of power. But if I go from 1 watt of power out of my handheld transmitter to 10 watts of power out of my transmitter, I have one ratio. And by the way that you calculate decibels, that would be a 10 decibel increase. And decibels are 10 times the log of P1 over P2, if you're talking about power. So you take the log of a ratio of 10 in power, 1 watt to 10 watt. I take the log of that to the base 10. I end up with an answer of 1. I multiply it by 10. I get an answer of 10. So 10 decibels of the ratio of power when I go from 1 watt to 10 watt. And if I'm going upward, 1 watt to 10 watt, I will call that a plus 10 decibel increase. If I'm starting off with 10 watts and I go down to 1 watt, I would call that a 10 decibel decrease. If I took the log of 1 over 10, I would end up with an answer of minus 1. When I multiply it by 10, I get minus 10 decibels ratio. It's not a real amount of power until you relate it to something. So 10 decibel increase or decrease is a 10 to 1 increase or decrease in power. Another number that a lot of people like to remember is a 2 to 1 difference. If I go from 1 watt to 2 watts, if I take the ratio of 2 to 1, log of that is 0.3, multiply it by 10, I get 3 decibels. So if I'm going from 1 watt to 2 watts, that is a 3 decibel increase. Go from 2 watts to 1 watt, that's minus 3 dB. Or you could say a 3 dB decrease. So now, because to try to get around that, people relate it to something that's very convenient. Well, to an RF engineer, a signal generator I think it's around 0.277 volts on a 50-ohm line. 1 milliwatt is a very convenient amount of reference power for an RF engineer. So with reference to 1 milliwatt, if I have exactly 1 milliwatt of power, and I'm doing I 1, I take the log of 1, it happens to equal 0, I know that doesn't make sense, but it does, and so 0 dBm, dB with reference to a milliwatt, that's what dBm stands for, dB with reference to a milliwatt. 0 dBm is 1 milliwatt. 2 milliwatts, above 0, is plus 3 dBm, that's 2 milliwatts. Again, if I start off with 1 milliwatt and I go down to half that power, half a milliwatt, I'm taking the log of 1 over 2, 1 half, that's minus 0.3, multiply it by 10 to follow the formula. 10 times 0.3 is minus 0.3, is minus 3. So when I go from 1 milliwatt to half a milliwatt, I have made a change of minus 3 decibels. 3 or half a milliwatt is minus 3 dBm, dB with reference to a milliwatt. So now, most RF engineers rate absolute power in dBm. A good handy talkie will easily receive a signal of minus 100 or 1 microvolt. So I can talk about microvolts on a 50-ohm line, convert it to milliwatts, take the log of it, I'll end up with minus 107 dBm. Cable TV people work in dB millivolts, dBmV. So their reference of power is a millivolt to give good operation of a television receiver and the signal coming down that cable. So they do dBmV. So there's a zillion reference points. Once again, decibels are a ratio, logarithmic ratio. The nice thing about these logs is you end up with convenient size numbers. And that first example I gave of the human hearing off the strongest possible signal, it is such a huge ratio, you'd be working with fantastically small numbers with lots of zeros after the decimal point, or fantastically big numbers with a lot of zeros after the unit scale, and so it'd be hard to work with, whereas decibels, much more convenient numbers, and it represents the way the human hearing really works. By the same token, your signal strength meter on your receiver, you have S0 through S9, each one of those represents 6 decibels of change of voltage. And since power is a function of voltage squared, 2-to-1 ratio in voltage is a 4-to-1 ratio in power.